We've reached the hour to start, and our esteemed president, Jim Ross, is going to issue a word of welcome to all of you, and then I'll have a few remarks, and then we'll hear from our speaker, Tom Ward, who's come all the way from Idaho to be with us.
Good afternoon, folks. It's nice to see this crowd here. This guy must be pretty good. Where is he? Where did he disappear to? Well, on behalf of the Anderson Forum for Progressive Theology, I would like to welcome everyone to our latest event. If you're not familiar with this organization, we have been around for 65 years. If you think about that, a progressive theology group in Anderson for 65 years, that's impressive. Typically, we have two events a year. We like to bring in speakers that talk about theology, talk about social issues, cultural issues. We run a pretty wide. There he is. He tried to slip out. So we try to cover a lot of different areas. Our goal is to build community through these conversations. That's been our motto, I guess, our mission statement is to bring people together and talk about these diverse ideas and hopefully make this a better place. So today we'll have a teaching session first from our speaker and then we'll have a break. Then we'll have a break, and we have some really nice refreshments, including wine. Father Jack and I had a nice conversation about that. He said, I'm glad y'all chose here, to do this. And I said, well, y'all let us drink. Terms I'm not bad in town, we can drink. So we're here tonight. So we'll have a break, have some snacks, and then we'll come back together for a question and answer period. And that's when we really want to get things going. We want everybody to participate. If you think of a question while our speaker is talking, write it down. Don't forget it, because we're going to make him work then. All right, so I'm going to introduce Stuart Sprague, one of our board members, and he's going to introduce our speaker for tonight. If you want to sign up for our website, you can Zoom on the little barcode over there or sign up, either one, and we'll get you on our website, on our email list. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And welcome to our Zoom audience. I'm not sure how many people are watching on Zoom right now. We might get a tally later today, but there are folks who are watching us online. So, and from some distant places around the world in some cases. We're happy to have you here. It's a long tradition that we have in this organization. We have never charged admission. There are folks who do this kind of work who sell tickets in advance, but we've never done that in all of our 60 years. We have, however, gratefully received contributions. And so there are envelopes around on chairs. Where is Polly, our treasurer? She must be out in the lobby. Anyhow, you will be able to deduct it. It's a tax-deductible gift if you identify yourself. And so we're happy to receive those contributions to help the tradition continue. We couldn't do it without contributions, really. And so it's an important part of our work. We are pleased to have as our speaker today Tom Ward. I met Tom in Wyoming last summer. Just on a lark, I was on the internet. I saw this conference. They were doing theology. There were some people going that I recognized. I didn't know Tom at the time. And I met him there, and it was a great experience. If you want to go to what's called OrtCon, O-R-T-C-O-N. He is the head of the ORT part, and then they do a C-I-C-O-N once a year. So if you see that on the internet, then you'll know, and maybe you'll want to go. Is it always in Wyoming?
Yes.
Okay. It's wonderful. Jackson Hole, Wyoming. I mean, I rode up the ski lift in the middle of the summer with Tom beside me. It was quite fun. Tom comes from the Nazarene tradition. He was educated at a Nazarene college and a Nazarene seminary. And he then went on. He was a pastor for a while. He also has a degree from the Claremont Graduate School in California, teaching or learning from folks like John Cobb and David Griffin, process theology, dear to my heart. And he then now teaches at Northwind Theological Seminary, which is a seminary in Florida, but does most of its work online. And I met one of his students. We rode back and forth to the airport in Wyoming, and he has a series of graduate students who are producing theses and writing books, and so you'll see his name in a lot of different places. But ORT is Open and Relational Theology, and that's a new paradigm, so to speak. And so we've asked him to come explain what that is, and we look forward to your presentation. In the break, meet people you haven't met before, talk about what Tom said in the first part of our session, and then come back after that and sit down, and we'll have a real good discussion about what you've learned and what your questions are after having heard our lecture. So, Tom, if you'll come, we'll hear you gladly.
Thank you, Stuart, and for that introduction, and thanks to all of you for coming out on a Thursday. I guess it's evening now. I really appreciate that. And those of you who are watching online, thanks for being a part of this. I'll try to make sure I include you as much as I can. You know, Stuart, when you were introducing me and talking about OrCon and us being together, I don't know if you know this, but 2 weeks after that, I got kicked out of the Church of the Nazarene. because I went through a trial for being queer affirming, and they not only took away my ordination, but they took my membership. So last summer when we were together, my mind was kind of in another place for much of that conference. But it's so good to be here with you and talking about something called Open and Relational Theology. I know some of you are veterans of this group, and you come because you're committed to the Anderson Forum for Progressive Theology. Others, this might be your first time. But I'm just kind of curious to start things off. How many people, prior to hearing about this event, had heard the phrase open and relational theology? Okay, good. Maybe a dozen, half dozen, not a ton. That means that's good, because that means I'm going to start with four and kind of build up. I know in the past we've had speakers that, or you've had speakers as part of this who attacked a particular topic or a theme or an issue. Open and relational theology is a grand scheme of thinking about God and creation that includes views on lots of particular themes and issues. So a lot of what I'm saying is going to kind of set the big stage, and then I'm hoping that you're going to be thinking in your head, oh, I wonder what the implications of that are for X or Y or Z. So let me jump right in. The words open and relational. What are we talking about? See if this is going to work here for me. There we go. Relational. What is that word all about? The word relational can mean a lot of different things, but in terms of open relational theology, it's a particular claim about a God who is not only influencing us and all of creation, but is actually influenced by us. So a God who's both giving and receiving. And in the open relational tradition, we like to think of us as being relational creatures living in a universe that's relational, in real giving and receiving relationship with a relational God. Now, you might say to yourself, ho-hum, doesn't everybody think God is relational? But the truth is, the majority of the major Christian thinkers, and I could also cite some Muslim and Jewish thinkers in Christian history, have said that God is not relational. I've got a few names up here. People like Augustine, Thomas Aquinas, Martin Luther, John Calvin. So people today who don't think God is relational. John Piper, David Bentley Hart, Catherine Sonderegger. They have said God is impassible, which is the $20,000 academic word for saying God is not affected one whit by what you do or the world does. And they've made that claim because they've been worried that if God were to be affected, if God were to somehow be influenced by what you do or your dog does, somebody does, then God would change. And that would be a bad thing. Because they assumed God was perfect, and if any kind of change came along, it would only have to be from perfection to imperfection, right? So they said, we want a perfect God, therefore, we don't think God is affected one bit. Not at all. This also meant that the God they believed in was not, didn't have emotional responses to creation. So, I mean, I'm guessing most of you have read the Bible once or twice, or at least parts of the Bible, and the God described there has a variety of emotions, positive, negative. God's sad sometimes, God's happy other times, God's jealous sometimes. There's all kinds of emotions described to God. But these folks, these major thinkers up here, have said God has no emotional response to creation. Now, God might sit around in God's self and think happy thoughts about God, but those aren't emotions in relation to us. Open to relational thought says, we think God really has emotional responses. We think God's happy when we treat one another on the earth well. We think God is sad when we don't treat each other in the earth well. God actually has an emotional reaction to what's going on in our world. That's a kind of a big deal. Now, this idea of change has been really important because I'm guessing, well, I'll put it this way. A lot of folks who think God never changes, which is, again, the fancy word is immutable, they have quoted particular passages like, I am the Lord, I changest not, to use the King James. And yet, lots of other passages say God does change. In fact, more than 40 times in the Old Testament, God is said to repent. And to repent is to have a change of mind, to be planning to do one thing and then, for whatever reason, usually in relation to creation, decide to do something else. And so we have this right in the scriptures themselves, this tension between a God who is said sometimes to be unchanging in all ways, but other times actually make some changes. So the problems with this particular kind of God is that at least, well, I would say the majority of scripture seems to paint a picture of the divine as affected, relational, emotional. I mean, words like God is creative, a living God, an incarnational God, redemptive, a compassionate. I mean, can you imagine true compassion as not involving any feelings or response? I mean, that just, it seems like the word compassion has to include that. And the way God is talked about, at least in some scriptures, is as a compassionate God. And yet if God is not relational, this doesn't seem to fit. For me, the biggest reason I'm a relational theologian is this last one. My commitment to love and belief that God is a perfect lover inclines me to think that God is really relational. Because I just don't know what true love looks like if it's not giving and receiving. Can you imagine being involved in a relationship and having a partner and saying, I'm not going to receive anything from you. I'm just going to give, give, give. I mean, that's actually the way some people think about God. God always gives, 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 gives. But if you actually read the scriptures and think about the logic of love, it seems like love requires this real interaction, mutuality, reciprocity. And that's at the heart of the open and relational tradition. Now I want to introduce I've been talking about 20,000 words. We'll make this a $40,000 phrase here. I want to introduce a kind of a technical idea because I mentioned earlier some biblical passages seem to talk about God as unchanging and others as changing. Is there some way we can account for both and take the best of both? For instance, I at least don't like the idea of a God who is loving sometimes and then changes to be a real asshole other times, right? So wouldn't it be kind of nice to say that God's love never changes, at least in the sense that God will always love? That seems kind of nice. On the other hand, since love is giving and receiving, there seems to be some change inherent in that. Well, here's the $40,000 phrase to account for that. God's experience, essence, finite. The idea here is that God is an experiential living God, and this experience changes moment by moment in giving and receiving relationship with us and all creation. But God's nature or essence, that remains unchanging. Let me see if I can throw an analogy out here. It's not a perfect one since we're talking about God, but Cliff, my friend over here in the plaid shirt, is that what that shirt is called? Anyway, yes. Cliff, he was born several years ago. And when he was born, he was a human. And today, he's a human. But the changes in Cliff's life from his being born to today are radical. He's a radically different person now than he was when he came out of his mother's womb. The fact that he's a human nature, you might say, that's remained unchanging. But how he experiences as a human changes moment by moment. God's kind of like that, except in God's case, God, I think, is everlasting, never had a beginning, never came out of anyone's womb, as I see it. That's the kind of idea I'm proposing here. This idea that God's experience is relational and changing, God's nature or essence is unchanging. In the process tradition, this is sometimes called dipolar theism. I have a different phrase for it. So that's the first word, relational. Second word, what is this word open about? I'm guessing no one woke up this morning and looked in the mirror and thought, I wonder if God is inside time or outside time. I do that occasionally. I wake up and think that, but some people don't. The idea of openness is a claim about God's relationship to time. I remember being as a 10-year-old in my Sunday school class at a Church of the Nazarene in which my Sunday school teacher confidently said, God is outside of time. God created time. And God stands above it all and sees the beginning and the end all at once. And I thought, wow, that blows my mind, but I guess that must be right. Now I totally disagree. Instead of being outside of the flow of time, I think God experiences the flow of time. And that's what the word open is about. The idea that God's a living God, engaging moment by moment, means that time is real for God. God is time-full, we might say, rather than timeless. And that means that the future is open. You probably heard the word predestination or foreordination, the idea that God determines ahead of time everything that's going to happen. We in the open relational tradition, we reject that view of predestination. But there's also some people who say that God doesn't predetermine or predecide the future, but in some mysterious way, God can know with absolute certainty everything that's ever going to happen. In the open relational tradition, we reject that one too. We think God knows everything that's knowable. God knows what happened already. God knows what's happening now. But the future isn't something anyone could know because it's not yet a fact. So God knows all the possibilities for the future, but God's not certain who's going to be the next president of the United States. I know who I want, but anyway. And us are moving through time together into an open and yet to be determined future. The future is not fixed. It's not set. And therefore, God knows what's possible, but isn't certain exactly what's going to happen. It's open. John Calvin wrestled with this issue, and John Calvin took the God outside of time view. And he had a really, I think, great illustration, even though I totally disagree with him. He had a great illustration to try to tell his audience what he meant by it. He said, imagine you're in your little town and someone went to the very top of the church bell tower, which in his day would have been probably the tallest thing in town. And from the bell tower, looked down at the street below and saw a parade. Now, from that lofty perspective, the person might be able to see the beginning of the parade and the end of the parade all at once. That's how God knows history, said John Calvin. God, in one eternal glance, sees it all, beginning to end. In the open and relational community, we reject that. We think God's in the parade, not watching us from a distance like Bette Midler's God. We think God is actually in the action, experiencing time moment by moment. So this is my best attempt at that. That's the Macy's Day Parade in New York. God is in the parade in open and relational thought rather than in the tower, seeing all of history. One of the ways many people start to warm up to open and relational thought is they start to think about the logic of petitionary prayer. Now imagine if you were going to pray and ask God to heal your sister or give you wisdom about how to deal with your grandchildren or your kid or somehow give you insight and help to change something for the future. If God already knows with absolute certainty everything that's going to happen, it seems like your prayer is purely futile. Like it seems like you're praying and asking God to do something that God already knows what's God going to do because his future is somehow settled and fixed and complete. So many people actually come to open and relational theology thinking, look, if my petitionary prayer is going to make any kind of sense, I mean, there's all kinds of questions about what prayer is about. We can get into those. But if it's going to make any kind of sense, the future has to be open in the sense that I can influence God at least in some way, and my actions can actually make a difference to what happens. So when it comes to petitionary prayer, open relational thought has a major, I think, upside. Okay, before I get to that, let me stop here just for a second to summarize, because I'm going to go a lot of different directions here. But I've really only done two things. I've told you what relational means in open and relational thought and openness. Relational is primarily about a God who gives and receives in real relation. And openness is primarily about a future that's open that even God doesn't know with absolute certainty. Now, who believes this stuff? What are the theological movements and ways of thinking that fit with this kind of stuff? Well, I put together a little umbrella under which are a bunch of different kind of theological themes. You might recognize some of them you might not. In the center are the ones who are, you'll find the most adherence to this view, something called process theology and open theology. You can see as we kind of go different directions, there are some Trinitarians who think this way, some Jewish theologies, actually some Muslim and Baha'i and some various religious traditions, liberationists, post-colonial, there's even some Catholics who think this way, someone like Ilya Delio, who some of you may know is over there, Teilhard de Chardin, and over this direction, feminist and womanist theologies. I grew up in the Wesleyan Arminian tradition, and there's some folks in that tradition who think this way, some missional. And there's others that I'm not putting there, but these are the ones that kind of first came to mind. I put these up here just to say Some of these people, like let's say Abraham Joshua Heschel, famous 20th century theologian, he never called himself an open relational theologian, but he fits comfortably here, even though he would first of all identify as a Jewish theologian. Or let's go down here. The first woman theologian in America who is a professional theologian teaching at a seminary was named Georgia Harkness. She taught at Garrett Evangelical Seminary. She's an open and relational theologian. She would have never used that phrase because it hadn't been invented in her day, but she had the kind of views that I've been outlining here. So this is kind of the range of the terms that kind of fall under this open and relational theology umbrella. Now, since this lecture is also looking at the roots of these ways of thinking, let me identify some sources, some congenialities, some collaborations between open and relational thought and other things. First of all, just let me say this. When I give a lecture on open and relational theology, most people are like this crowd. Most people have never heard of it before. And I lay it all out, and after I'm done, I can guarantee there's going to be some people who walk up to me and say, you know, I've already kind of believed that. I just didn't have a label because it fits my experience. And I think that's one of the biggest pluses to open and relational thought. It just fits the way most people live. And that's then a source. We take lived experience seriously. Now, if you're into theology, and you know something about the history of theology, I'll say, you know, we're like Friedrich Schleiermacher in the modern theology. It starts with experience. Or if you're into mysticism, we care about the mystical experience. Or somebody was a Pentecostal here. Pentecostals, they understand starting with experience because they want to account for the dramatic experiences they have. Lived experience is really important for this theological tradition. We also, at least some of us in the tradition, take the scriptures seriously. I come from the Christian tradition. I still try to follow Jesus. That's part of my past and my present. And I think that the majority of scriptures point to this particular perspective. Not all of them. Let me be clear about that. There are some passages of scripture that paint God as a, well, watch my language here. God as a bad guy. And I think those scriptures are flat wrong. But I think the general drift of scripture that points to a God of love and the revelation we find in Jesus of Nazareth, who I think points to a God of love. I think open and relational theology draws from what I like to say are the best of the scriptures, maybe not absolutely every one of them. So that's a source. Also, because we think God is in time, this tradition has taken what many people today call historical consciousness seriously. That is, you know, think about people who lived 500 years ago. You know, they thought about the past, obviously, but they didn't have the kind of periods of history that we think about. They didn't have an evolutionary story to think about 13 billion years of being on this planet. We live in a day in which we think about the flow of history in a way very different from people, at least the typical person, 500 years ago. Open relational theology embraces that historicism. This notion in the fights within Christianity, at least in Protestant Christianity, between the Catholics and the Arminians over free will and God's grace, we're on the Arminian side. I do know there's some Calvinists who are open to relational thought thinkers, but they side with Arminius on this question, that we think there's genuine freedom and God's grace comes first. There was a really influential philosophical movement in America in the early 20th century called Boston Personalism. Martin Luther King Jr., personalist. He got his degree at Boston University and wrote on personalism. Personalism is a way to think that we should start with our experience as persons when we think about reality and think about God. That kind of thinking also fits open and relational thought. And then there's a ton of different philosophers who've been drawn from to carve out this way of thinking. One of the most famous is a guy named Alfred North Whitehead, but people like Don Dewey, William James, I can just go on and on. There's tons of them. Open relational thinking is also known for taking science very seriously, fitting the evolutionary story of the universe. Of course, there's lots of different theories in science, and I'm not saying that absolutely everyone, you know, aligned with open and relational thought, but generally speaking, the major theories in science align nicely with open and relational thought, and therefore, most of the leading science or religion scholars in the last 50 years are somehow associated with open and relational thought, because it just fits so well in that dialogue. The number one reason I'm into this, those other ones matter, but the number one for me is, again, I'm committed to love. I'm a person who grew up in a very conservative tradition, was an evangelist in college. I had the kind of kid who would sit next to you on the plane and pull out the four spiritual laws and want you to get on your knees and say, accept Jesus into your heart. That was the kind of person I was. And then near the end of my college career, I took a course in philosophy of religion. And for the first time, really took seriously the writings of atheists, agnostics, from other religious traditions. And for the sake of intellectual honesty, I had to admit I didn't think God exists. In fact, I remember coming to pick up my wife, my fiance, who's now my wife, her getting in the car, me looking at her and saying, I just can't believe in God anymore. Here we were both preparing for ministry and like, believing in God is usually kind of part of the deal when it comes to some exceptions, but yeah, I eventually came back to belief in God, primarily based on two things. One, my search for meaning. I didn't think I could have ultimate meaning if there wasn't some ultimate ground or source of meaning that most people call God. But secondly, I had these deep intuitions that I ought to be a loving person, that in some sense, love must be the answer. And I couldn't make good sense of those deep intuitions if there wasn't some kind of wellspring, source, lover that inspired those. And so for me, love has been at the heart of my thinking about God and the world. And open and relational theology, I think, does a far better job of any theology I know of crafting and explaining well the general features of love and the details. I'll talk about that a little bit more later. Finally, I put this up there, even though it's a little bit anachronistic, but it is the case that open and relational folks have tended to fit very well in liberationist agenda. I don't know if some of you might not know what post-colonial thinking is, but that's a way of rethinking power structures in terms of governments and the past history of nation states who've come into places around the world and decided they were claiming them for Christ and then oppressing them. Feminist thinking, ecological thinking. I don't know if it's quite right to say that it's part of the roots, but at least it fits very nicely with open and relational thinkers. And so a lot of folks would identify first as, let's say, a feminist or a liberationist, would also hear the themes of open and relational thought and go, oh yeah, that's me too. A few more common ideas. So now I want to transition a bit. I gave you what open and relational was, and then I transitioned to some of the sources and some of the key ideas. Now I want to look at a few other things that aren't like part of the title open and relational, but are very widely embraced in the open and relational community. So, number one, I've already kind of been mentioning the God of love, a giving and receiving love. But secondly, we take freedom seriously. We don't think that we're entirely determined by our past, our genes, our neurons, culture, God. We think we have what I like to call genuine but limited free will. We're not free to do absolutely anything. But given the options in the moment, we think we make free choices. That's part of our tradition. Also, and this makes some people uncomfortable, but I'll just put it out there, we think God needs us. We think that our choices actually matter, that love can't win unless we cooperate with God. And that makes some people really happy because that kind of fits the way they already live. And other people kind of depressed, like, ugh, what I do matters? That sucks. And to those people, I like to say, you don't, you're not carrying the whole world on your shoulders. Your lives do matter. Your choices do matter. But your choices are in the context and the situation you're in. But that's a big deal. Another word you'll hear bandied about a lot in this community is the word panentheism. It's a word that has been given a lot of different meanings, but I think it ultimately means something like creation is in God's experience. Right now I'm talking and I'm in your experience. I'm not omnipresent, so I'm not in the experience of everyone, and the whole world isn't in my experience. The idea of panentheism is that God is present to all of creation and absolutely everything, from quarks to quails to koala bears to quasars, all of it affects God, and God takes it into God's experience moment by moment. Another big idea, we think creation has real value. Humans are real, actually valuable, but not just humans, other creatures and the planet, even down to the smallest molecules. That's why we take ecology and environmental issues seriously, because all creation has intrinsic value. That means it's not just valuable for what it can serve, how it can serve us, but it's also valuable in and of itself. We live in an experiential universe. Now, this one's not quite as widely embraced in the open relational community, but this, in philosophical terms, is called panpsychism. Doug, is I feel like I'm getting some feedback here. Am I doing something weird with this mic? Not sure. All right, I'll try to just behave myself. The idea that not only are you an experiencing individual, but so is your cat. And so is the mouse your cat ate. And so is right down to the smallest entities. And there's lots of different theories on this and how much is it experiential and conscious. And there's all kinds of debates about this. But a lot of folks in the open relational camp wants to extend experience down to the smallest levels of reality, not just in humans. We also are the kind of people who are always engaging lots and lots of other resources. So some people in the open relational community came to it through the arts. Some people came through the sciences, the social sciences or the physical sciences. Some people came through theology study, reading the Bible. There's all kinds of entry points. But because we think we can find wisdom everywhere and not just in one religious tradition, we're open to seeking wisdom everywhere. And finally, in the open relational tradition, we think the traditional views of God's power need to be rethought. And what I want to end my lecture with today is a rethinking of God's power. What I'm going to propose is not what everybody in the open relational camp thinks. So these are my ideas. Not everyone would agree with me. There's plenty who would, but there are others who wouldn't. But I want to rethink God's power in light of the number one reason atheists say they don't believe in God. You look at polls, atheists give lots of reasons, evolution, whatever, hypocrites, Christians who are hypocrites, whatever. But the number one reason is, if there's a God who's supposed to be omnipotent and perfectly loving, then why doesn't this God stop, prevent the crap that happens in our world? And crap is a very mild word that I could use, much more violent words. Why doesn't this God prevent genuine evil? Now, I grew up in a tradition, a free will tradition, where we would say, well, God gives free will, and therefore God allows evil. God permits evil. And for a while, I swallowed that. But then I thought, hold on a second. Wouldn't a genuinely loving person stop the evil that person could stop? I live in Idaho, and right behind my house is a stream about the size of this room. And it's about as deep as my belly. When my kids, I have three daughters, when they were younger, they liked to play in that stream. Imagine I'm out working in my yard, doing yard work, and my three daughters are in the stream, and they get in a little bit of a fight. And my oldest daughter, whose name is Sydney, decides to take my youngest daughter's head, put it under the water, and drown her. Kill her. Now suppose I'm close enough, I can intervene, walk into the water, rescue my youngest daughter. But suppose I said, you know, I'm not causing this death. I think I'll just permit it. I'll allow it. I mean, you can't blame me. I'm not doing it. Now, if I took that approach and just let my oldest daughter drown my youngest daughter, nobody in my subdivision would vote me Father of the Year. Right? My wife would not be happy. I would not be a moral exemplar, because we think people who have the ability to prevent genuine evil and don't do it aren't perfectly loving. Most people I know think God has the kind of abilities and power to stop evil, but just permits it, allows it. I think that's a picture of a God who's not perfectly loving. So, what do we do about this? Well, I'm a Christian, and the scriptures have been important to me, and so one of the things I try to do when I have a difficult question is go to the big book, the Holy Bible. What does it say? Well, I'm not coming to you tonight saying I have found the one verse that everyone else has missed in the history of Christianity that solves this question. In fact, there's a great book written about 10 years ago by an eminent biblical scholar over at Chapel Hill named Bart Ehrman. And the book is called God's Problem. I don't know if you can see the subtitle in the back. The subtitle is How the Bible Fails to Answer Our Most Important Question. Why we suffer. Bart Ehrman is a really interesting guy. He grew up in a hardcore fundamentalist Christian home. He went off to college at Moody Bible Institute. Anybody ever heard of Moody Bible? We are talking ultra-right. After Moody, he went to Wheaton. Maybe not ultra-right, but still right. And then got his PhD at Princeton in New Testament. And in that process, he went from being a fundamentalist to an atheist. And he wrote this book saying, does the Bible help us answer the biggest question that not only believers are asking, but atheists are asking as well? The question of why we suffer. And he concludes this. If there is a God, he's not the kind of being that I believed in as an evangelical, a personal deity who has ultimate power over this world and intervenes in human affairs to implement his will among us. He goes on, if God cures cancer, why do millions die of cancer? If the response to this question is, well, it's a mystery. You know, God's ways are not our ways. God works in mysterious ways. Well, that's the same as saying that we do not know what God does, or what he is like, so why should we pretend that we do? I think he's spot on. But tonight, I'm going to offer a solution to the problem. How's that for having a big head? I'm serious. I'm actually going to solve the number one reason atheists say they can't believe in God, and I'm not screwing around. I'm going to put a proposal on the table that I think is a solution to this big question. You can come back at me hard and question it, but I'm going to put it out there. First, let me tell you what it's going to be in general, and then I'm going to talk about five steps to it. I'm going to say that God is love as a self-giving, others-empowering, and this is going to be the key word, uncontrollably. God is uncontrolling. I invented a word I'll tell you about in a moment called omnipotence.
Consequently, God can't
control.
Not won't. Not God could, but chooses not to. God simply can't control.
Therefore, since God can't control, God can't stop evil single-handedly. All right, here's some details in this big. Oh, these are some books that I'm going to talk about. The God Can't one is the one I'm going to explore. But this last one is a more recent, more scholarly one if you care about lots of scholarly stuff. But there you go. First step. Let me start with the most controversial part of my solution, the God can't one. Shocks lots of people when I say that. And especially when I'm in more conservative settings, I like to then go to the Bible and start listing all the biblical passages that say things like, God can't tell a lie. God can't be tempted. God can't grow tired. My favorite one is in Timothy. When we are faithless, God remains faithful because God cannot deny himself, God's self. That is, God can't go against God's own nature. I'm going to make the claim that God's nature is love, and God's love is always uncontrolling, and therefore God can control not only humans, but your dog and cells and quirks. From the most complex to the least, God loves it all, and God's love is always uncontrolling, and therefore God can't control anyone or anything. I call this omnipotence because I don't like the word omnipotent. I could go into details in the Q&A, but omnipotent is the power of uncontrolling love. It's a word I invented because I didn't like the other one. It's God self-giving, others-empowering, and therefore uncontrolling love for everyone and everything. And that means God can't control anyone or anything that causes evil. I think this love makes a real difference everywhere, all the time. I even think that whatever miracles occur have this uncontrolling love as their source, but also creaturely contributions. I think it's at the heart of salvation and all the different ways we might want to think about that. And I trust in this uncontrolling love for the eschatological victory, which is a $20,000 word way of saying that love could win at the end. That's pretty big for me. All right, so that's the first part of this. Now, second part, I believe in a God who suffers with us. A God who's present and receptive everywhere, and everything that happens has an impact on God, which means that when we suffer, we have a God who feels pain with us. And that means we can imitate this fellow sufferer who understands when we suffer with others. Now, in the academy where I spend a lot of my time, I've got a lot of fellow theologians. When they come to the problem of evil, they go to this one, and that's all the farther they get. They don't have they don't have the balls to say God can't do something. Maybe it's not balls, but they don't go that direction. I think this isn't enough. Suffering with others, I think that's important. But it's kind of a masochist who could stop the evil, chooses not to, just so that person could suffer with those in pain. Supposing after we're done here, Cliff and I go out to the road, and we're walking down the sidewalk, and I don't know, who am I going to pick on? It's one of you. I won't make anybody the bad person here. One of you comes down the road and Stuart. I'm with Stuart. Change my story. Because I would pick on you. This is Stuart and I walking. Someone hits Stuart. Hits then the side of the pavement. Flips over, and the car lands on Stuart. And I'm right next to him, and it didn't hit me at all. So imagine now, Stuart, I need to stay in front of this camera, don't I? Stuart is on the ground, the car's landed on him, and he's suffocating. He can't breathe. Imagine I come up to Stuart, and I see that the way the car is laid on his chest,
I actually have the leverage to push it off him and save his life. And Stuart says, Tom, help him out. Suppose I get down next to him, I hold his hand, and I say, you know, Stuart, I could get this off of you, but I'm just going to suffer with you as you die. That's not a loving thing to do, right? If I have the ability to stop his death, a loving thing to do would to do that. Simply suffering with it isn't enough. So while I think this is an important part of the whole thing, it's not in itself enough. And I encourage my fellow theologians to take a stronger claim about God's power. Third thing, what about healing? I have some people that talk about this too, and they say, you know, I don't really care why it happened. I just want to get past it. I just want to heal. I want a God who can heal me. And I do too. I think God is always working to heal, but can't heal single-handedly. So every time there's a healing, whether it's through conventional medicine or praying at the altar or alternative medicine or some fluke or whatever, I think God is at work always, always trying to heal those who are injured and broken by misfortune, evil, sin, and whatever. God can't do it all alone. God requires cooperation from our bodies, from medicines, from environment, from choices. So God always works in tandem with entities, selves, individuals, communities, circumstances to bring whatever healing and wholeness is possible given the circumstances. Sometimes the circumstances just don't allow for the full healing that we want, at least not in this life. I happen to believe in life after death, and I think some of this healing can come then. So, healing is part of my answer too. Fourth one. Here I want to go to another person that, there's enough older people in this room, you might know this person. Anybody ever heard of Johnny Erickson Tada? Okay, yeah, I was about right, about a dozen.
Let me tell you about her yesterday.
Let me tell you her story. When she was about 16, she's in the Chesapeake Bay with her family. She jumps out of her boat into the water, doesn't see, I don't know if it's a sandbar or a rock or something, anyway, right below the surface, breaks her neck, paralyzed from the neck down. She responds to that by becoming an amazing public speaker, cutting a bunch of albums, writing books, learns how to paint with her teeth, and she does it far better than most people I know who could do it with her hands. Absolutely amazing. She's got like 7 honorary doctorates. She started an organization for people with disabilities, yada, yada, yada. I happened to come across her website 50 years after her accident, and this is what she wrote. Often when I share my testimony, I reflect on how off track I had become in my Christian life before my diving accident. You know, I said recently, I was involved in some pretty immoral stuff when I was on my feet. Even though I was a Christian, I was sinning big time, heading down a wrong path, deep in my heart. I know that if my accident hadn't happened, I would have completely ignored my convictions in college. Someone who was listening asked me, Johnny, are you saying that God was punishing you with a broken neck? It was a good question. My mind went to Hebrews 12:6, which says, the Lord disciplines those he loves, and he punishes everyone he accepts as a son. And I had to look that person straight in the eye and say, yes, I believe God was punishing me for doing wrong. I think Johnny Erickson Tada is an amazing person with amazingly bad theology. I don't think God's in the punishing business. I think God looks down at a 16-year-old and says, you're really sinning big time. I'm going to bust your neck. Not the God I believe in. I don't think genuine evil is ever divine punishment or part of some plan of God. But, and here's the key point, I think God works with us in creation to try to squeeze something good out of the bad God didn't want in the first place. So when Johnny Erickson looks at her life ministry and sees all the amazing things that came out of it, she assumes it was a part of God's plan, God was punishing her, and therefore all these good things to have that bad thing to make them happen. I don't think like that. I think God never gives up on anyone or anything and works with us to try to bring something good out of what God didn't want in the first place. That's a different way to think. God responds and then offers new possibilities, gives us possible. Some things just aren't possible, but gives new possibilities to grow, heal, mature, and learn. Fourth or fifth big idea. We have a role to play. God is calling us to join the work to defeat evil. Remember I said earlier that God needs you? God calls upon all creatures, not just humans, to cooperate to make the world a better place. I call this indispensable love synergy. Love requires a synergy between God and us. And therefore, we should respond to these divine calls by doing things like comforting the afflicted, consoling those in pain, working to convince those who act in evil ways to act instead for good. I'm going to resist the temptation to talk about Donald Trump right here. So you can see where this is going. We have a role to play in resisting what's happening in Washington that is against our interests, the interests of the vulnerable, against the interests of the trans, people of color, you got it? I didn't resist that, did I? I actually went for it. And forming people and structures that minimize evil and promote good. We have a role to play. It's not all on God. It's not all on us. God and us is the hope of the world. And finally, before I do this one, I should say, this book, God Can't, has five chapters. And the five things we've said so far are the five chapters where I lay out those. After I got done writing the book, I wish I had written one more chapter. And now I'm going to talk about what I would have written that last chapter. Because there's another issue. If God created the whole thing, then why doesn't God stop the crap that happens? Or as someone on Facebook put it, if God created men, women, all creatures and the universe in six freaking days, why is he so powerless to change the horrible things that happen on earth? He's freaking God. With a wave of a hand, he should be able to prevent evil. I have to conclude, God does not exist. Now, this is getting kind of technical, but this is progressive theology forum, so I can technical here for a second. Most people, since about the 3rd century, most Christians, have believed that God created the world out of absolute nothing. The Latin phrase is creatio ex nihilo. It's not an idea that's in the Bible. It's not in Genesis 1, but it has emerged over time. If God has the power to create something out of nothing, then the whole wave of the hand, then I think this person is right, that God ought to be able to stop evil. But today I want to suggest we need a new doctrine of creation that gets rid of creation out of nothing. And I've got a proposal for you. God everlastingly and in love creates something new each moment out of or in relation to what God created previously. So instead of there being an absolute beginning of time, God is always creating, moment by moment, out of what God created previously, and there was no T-0, no first moment. There's a first moment to our universe 13.8 billion years ago, whatever physicists are saying now, but our universe was preceded by something else, because God has always been creating. I call this, if you want the Latin, creatio ex creatione, aeternalis in amore. God never then creates something from nothing with a wave of a hand. God always creates alongside creation. Because that's the case, God can't control anyone or anything because creation is a cooperative venture. And therefore, what we call the natural laws are either the inherent capability of creation or God's relentless love in the world. All right, I'm now to the conclusion. I've laid a lot of ideas on you. I'm guessing we're going to have a robust Q&A after our little break here. But I want to conclude by a little testimonial. I get tons of letters from people who read my books, especially my book, God Can't, the one that I've kind of been laying out the big ideas for. And here's one that I especially like that I got recently. I've suffered my entire life from severe childhood trauma. The height of my despair came from trying to understand why an all-powerful God chooses to let us suffer for the sake of others' free will, for a greater good, if I could just pronounce that as the BS that it is. I've wrestled with the inconsistencies, not only in Scripture, but with the God of Scripture, especially concerning the treatment of women. God can apparently audibly speak, "Don't steal," but not, "Don't rape my girls." God can't renew my faith in a loving God. She goes on to talk about the abuse that she faced and the kind of answers people gave her and her realizing that if God can't control others, God's not culpable for what happened to her. So, those are a bunch of big ideas. I gave you what open relational theology was like in general. I talked a little bit about its roots and sources. And then I dug into the number one reason why atheists say they can't believe in God. And I'm suspecting it's the number one question that believers have as well. The problem of evil. And I stuck my neck out and I proposed a solution. I need to say that not only what I've said here at the end, but even at the beginning in open relational theology, I'm not 100% certain these are right. These ideas weren't downloaded into my head straight from the Holy Spirit. I could be wrong. But these are the best ideas I know, and they've been helpful to me and many others. So I'd love to hear your response after the break.
Tom, we thank you for a wonderful presentation. And we look forward to the give and take that will follow. So come lead us.
I attended a lecture by Bart Ehrman one time, and I was disappointed that he, you know, just because there's evil in the world, he's not going to believe in God. So I said, "Don't you think God is sad when these things happen?" He said, "Well, yeah."
I find him to be a good-natured guy, but this was the issue that led him to become an atheist. Yeah. It was the problem of evil.
I came upon this thinking out of a book I read 25 years ago, maybe, called God of the Possible by Greg Boyle.
Oh, great book.
And what really grabbed me was something you mentioned, that God responds to prayer.
Yeah.
That was the big deal for me at that point in my life.
Yeah, yeah.
So.
Excellent. Yeah, God of the Possible is the name of the book. And it was written about 30 years ago when I was teaching undergraduates who came from more evangelical backgrounds. That would be the book I would give them if they had questions, because it's got a lot of scripture and it's easy to read, and prayer is a big issue in there. Yeah, thanks.
Not really a question, but maybe a comment. So interesting lecture, and I really like the way you ended it, mm-hmm. because that was my question. How do you know any of this?
Yeah.
Unless you just want to write a book. I'm kidding.
Yeah.
But why not leave room for the mystery? Why feel that there needs to be an explanation or a definition that makes us feel comfortable to exist as human beings and suffer the crises we all have as living a human life?
Yeah.
Like, I've never, I think everybody here has suffered in life. I don't think you can get a free pass.
Yeah.
And I've never felt the need to blame God for any of that. Instead, I've leaned on God to help me face that storm.
Okay.
So it's interesting, the need to explain that God.
Thank you for saying that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think, is it okay if we kind of riff a little bit on what I think about mystery?
Oh, yeah.
I'll make that your question.
Thank you.
I embrace mystery in at least two senses. First of all, I'm not certain there is a God. So in that sense, it's a mystery. In fact, I kind of worry a little bit about people who think they've got God all figured out. So I'm not even certain there is a God. Now, I'm giving my whole life believing that, or risking that there is, but I'm not certain about that. Secondly, you know, there's that passage in Scripture that says we know in part, but then we'll be known full, or we'll be fully known, that sort of thing. I not only think we should talk about mystery when it comes to whether there's a God, but I also don't want to claim to know everything there is to know about God if there is one. So mystery in both those senses. But there are some mystery elements that I felt like. And maybe you're going to disagree with me on this, but I'll put them out there. I know some people who appeal to mystery because they don't want to rethink the view of God that they've been given. So, like, I'm sometimes in a conversation with my more conservative friends, and they're absolutely sure God is in control, God is sovereign, God is omnipotent. And then I bring up the kinds of stuff that I've talked about tonight. And instead of rethinking their view of God's power, they say, well, it's a mystery. Who can know? And I think, oh, come on now. Why are you unwilling to give this up? Maybe you ought to wrestle a little bit more with that. So that's one kind of appeal to mystery that I don't like. And then I'm gonna really step on toes now. In the more liberal traditions that I talk to, I know some people who don't seem to want to have to make much of any claim about God. And they appeal to mystery quickly, quickly, quickly. And maybe I'm just a weirdo, but I kind of want to have something that I think might be the case. Again, I don't know for sure. I know how I'll explain this. When I was an undergraduate, I was required to read a little book by J.B. Phillips called Your God is Too Small. And that little book talks about how people imagine God as the grandpa in the sky or the policeman or the Santa Claus or whatever. And the basic argument was, look, you need to think about God bigger. I also came across a book about 20 years ago in which the people said in it, your God is too big. And by that they meant, you've got a God with all these omnis, omniscient, omnipotent, yada, yada, and that just doesn't fit the world we live in. So your God is too big. We need a right-sized God. Some of my more conservative friends seem to know way too much about God. They have a God who's, I like to say, is too definite. And it seems like they're so convinced on all these details that I just think, you seem to know too much. But some of my more liberal friends have a God who I think is too vague. They're not enough to that God. And I'm trying to strike a balance. And maybe I'm not doing a very good job. But I kind of want to have some things that I think might be more plausible than others, but definitely appeal to mystery even saying I'm not sure. What do you think of that? Oh, you don't have the mic anymore.
So, I think sometimes us humans complicate everything.
Sure.
And I think in some ways I'm really lucky because I grew up in the Armenian church and I didn't speak ancient Armenian, so I didn't understand everything. And so instead I looked at the elders at the front of the church that literally would keep their hands open and tears just coming down.
Mm.
So as a child, I decided God was love. Mm. As simple as that.
Beautiful.
So I don't try to define everything. So maybe I'm somewhere in the middle with the very liberal and
yeah.
the non-conservative at all. But
good. Well, thank you.
That's where.
Awesome. I appreciate that.
I'm wondering what, if anything, ORT has to say about the death of Jesus, and particularly the evangelical view of Jesus dying for our sins and atonement and all that.
Yeah, the vast majority of ORT people reject substitution, you know, what's the word? What's the usual?
Penal
substitute. Yeah. The vast majority. There may be someone who accepts it, but I don't know that person. But there are a variety of views that are being offered, you know, as alternatives. Someone like Greg Boyd has a kind of a Christus Victor view. Others have, say, you know, Jesus died because Jesus opposed the authorities and the empire and they killed him and it wasn't a part of some God plan that God had from all eternity. So there's a lot of options there on the table, but I can't think of anybody who has the kind of typical evangelical view of atonement.
That's also a Catholic view of atonement.
Catholic, that's true. Most Catholics, I mean, there's a variety in Catholicism, but yeah, there's a lot of Catholics who have that view.
So, kind of interested in the distinction between panentheism, which you mentioned, versus pan. When I was going to college, I majored in philosophy and religion. It was a combined major. Whoops. And when I first heard of pantheism, I don't
know if that's you or me.
Why doesn't pantheism? I'm not doing this one. Okay, I'll keep it away from my face. So I had a traditional notion of God at the time, and I loved the idea of pantheism, but it conflicted, it sort of took away the God dude that loved me. And then I heard of panen, and I was like, oh, much better, because in panentheism, panen for anybody, I'm sorry, pantheism for people who aren't aware, is kind of like, the universe and all of reality, that's God. And that's all there is. There's no God outside of that God. That's just God. And I couldn't quite accept that, but I could accept that there's a God that is all of the universe and it's something more.
Yeah.
Now I've flipped.
Yeah.
Over the years, I'm at the other end. And if I had to give myself a category, I wouldn't be atheist at all, but I am truly agnostic and I very distinctly don't believe in most of the traditional gods. They strike me as person A says God is this, person B says God is that, person C says God is this.
Sure, sure.
And I go, well, each one of those is a mask on the face of ultimate reality. So every one of those gods is an idol before ultimate God. And I think it was Bulman, you're a theologian, you probably know Bulman,
yeah,
who had a line, and below the line was the God of our concepts, and above was a giant question mark. Mm. I wonder if you have any comments on that.
Yeah, if our claims about God have to be 100% true, otherwise we're committing idolatry, then I'm the biggest idolater there is. I don't know if my views of God match perfectly onto to God. So I think we're all going to consciously or subconsciously make claims about God that tell us something about who we are. There's always going to be something going on there. But I think that doesn't mean that there still can't be a God who transcends that. And I happen to believe there is. I understand the attraction of pantheism because I'm an outdoors guy. And there are some times when I'm in the woods and I just think, oh, man, this is God, you know. But if pantheism is true and everything is God, I would have to say Donald Trump is God, and I definitely will not do that.
but you can agree that in any version of God, God created Donald Trump, and God doesn't stop any.
Well, in pantheism, God didn't create Donald Trump. God is Donald Trump.
In panentheism as well.
Panentheism, no, there's a distinction between God and the world in panentheism. Everything is in God, but God is not everything. That's usually the way it's understood. Yeah. Good stuff. Thank you. Yeah.
Sorry.
So I had a question about just like the nature of God can't and the nature of evil being perpetrated by people who are his creations.
Yeah.
Right. So if God can't betray his own nature by your summary earlier, sorry.
No, that's probably me.
And evil is something that mankind creates or perpetrates, right? It's kind of implying one of two things. Either God created something that was capable of doing something he couldn't, or that evil is part of the nature of mankind. And I was wondering what you had to say about that.
Yeah, awesome. I tried to address that in that last point, but I was pretty quick. And so I totally get why I need to expand on that. So I'm rejecting the idea that creation is inherently evil. So I'm not a dualist, a Manichaean is what's the classical. I'm not saying creation is intrinsically evil. I am saying, though, that creation has the capacity or the possibility to do good or evil. And creatures, not just humans, but others, sometimes either purposely or accidentally, do what's evil. Your good question is, okay, but if God created it, then did God create the possibilities for good and evil? And my attempt to answer that was to say, yes, God created it, but never out of nothing, always in relation to what God previously created, and therefore the inherent possibilities for good and evil are baked into creation everlastingly. It's a wild idea. I don't know, well, I shouldn't say I don't know any other theologian who has it, but I'm one of the very few that would make that kind of claim. And I'm writing a systematic theology where I'm laying out all the details of that. So if you're interested in that sort of stuff, check out my Substack. Somebody else. Well, whoever has, do you have a mic?
I don't, but I'll think you can hear me.
There, yeah.
Okay. You mentioned earlier that you believe in an afterlife.
Yeah.
How do you reconcile that with God?
Yeah.
I mean, is that a God thing that you're talking about there, or is that a something that just happens?
Mm. I don't think the afterlife is made possible by God alone, because that would take a kind of controlling act, I think, and I don't think God can control. But I do think it does require God's activity, so it's not just us alone either. I'm not sure there's an afterlife, by the way, but I think we have reasons to hope that there is. And strangely enough, probably my biggest piece of evidence are near-death experiences, out-of-body experiences, what's oftentimes called parapsychology and that sort of stuff. Those don't prove it, but I think they give us some evidence. And then the notion that there's a God of love who I don't think wants to give up on anybody. I think God would like to see the possibility for abundant life continue. So that's how I kind of see it. God and creation. Actually, I think I want to riff on your question, kind of expand it a little bit, okay? Because one of the things I didn't mention is that I don't think there's any open and relational theologians who believe in the traditional idea of hell. Now, maybe, but I can't think of anybody. And that is the idea that God would send people to eternal conscious torment. It's just, I can't think of anybody who thinks that. Now, there's some other options on the table. One of them is annihilationism. That is, God doesn't send anybody to hell, but God just annihilates, wastes, eliminates those who are unrepentant. Greg Boyd would be someone who buys into that, who he was mentioned earlier. I don't like annihilationism for a number of reasons. I think it means that God gives up on some people, means that some people are irredeemable, and that seems like a real pessimistic view. And since I don't think God knows the future, I don't think God knows who's going to eventually cooperate. So annihilationism just doesn't strike me as very helpful. Then you got someone like David Bentley Hart, who's not an open relational theologian, but he's a universalist. Or we could take Karl Barth as a good example here as well. These folks think that God will eventually, everyone goes to the good place, whatever that looks like. And Barth would say God can do it because God has this omnipotent power.
Now, I don't like that because if God has that power to fix things in the end, why isn't God doing it now? The problem of evil just comes right back at you. David Bentley Hart thinks that God created things at the beginning so that eventually everything gets back. And to that view, I say, well, if God, it seems like that cheapens our life in some way, that if in some way it's going to be okay at the end, our lives don't really seem to matter because God had baked into the beginning that everything is going to work out okay. My view is this. God, in every moment, invites us and calls us to love in this life and in the afterlife. I believe in what philosophers would call subjective experience beyond bodily death. And I don't think God ever gives up inviting us to love relationship. When we cooperate with God, we enjoy the positive, the natural positive consequences that come from living a life of love. When we don't cooperate, God doesn't kick our butts or punish us, but there's just natural negative consequences that come from saying no to love, because love is about abundant life. And that means that, in my view, God's relentless love never stops pursuing anyone, ever. God doesn't say, you know, I've given Polly 1,900,680 times. I'm not giving her one more. God's always, always. Now, because I don't have a God who's omnipotent, I can't guarantee that God will make sure everyone enjoys abundant life, because I think God's always inviting. But because I got a God who never gives up, I have the hope that God's relentless love will eventually convince everyone and everything capable of responding to say yes to love. That's a long answer, sorry.
How's that different from universalism?
Some people might call that a hopeful universalism, but I'm trying to contrast that view of universalism with a God who makes sure everybody gets to the good place by either omnipotent control, like Karl Barth's God seems to do, or a God who kind of created everything so that it'll eventually be in the good place, which is a David Bentley Hart. Those kinds of universalism, they can say, we're guaranteed that everyone go. I can't say that because I don't have an omnipotent God, but I have this God who always loves and never forces.
I like the no punishment thing.
I do too.
Because people don't deserve help. Nobody deserves help.
No.
But I just wanted to say that my thoughts are that God made the universe or created it in conjunction with physics.
Yeah.
But I think God, then that's why he doesn't heal everybody and just make everything like beautiful roses and butterflies, you know. He doesn't break his own laws, or he doesn't break the laws of creation. He could, but he just doesn't usually, you know.
Yeah. And I would say it even stronger that God can't break those laws because those laws are expressions of God's loving nature.
God can't break his laws if
he
doesn't want to, I think.
Okay, well, we'll give this a try. You said something there that I want to riff on a little bit also, because Dave came up to me, or maybe it was Dave, somebody came up to me at the break and said, if God created everything, why did God create cookies that taste so good but are so bad for me? And I love that question.
The good thing is God does, you know, we haven't learned that by the time we're as old as I am. Much of anything is God.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one answer is that there are evolutionary reasons for why we'd be attracted to sugar and that sort of thing. And I'm on board with those kinds of things. But I don't think they give us the full answer. But what I want to stress is that I think we, in general, believers and theists in general, have tended to say God created X, and we've meant by that God alone created X. And I'm rejecting that view.
Like, did God create me? Well, what about my parents having sex? Right? What about me eating food that's part of my being created moment by moment? There's lots of things that are going into creating me. Now, I think God plays an essential role in that. But I think that questions about what did God create, we have to always remember, at least in my way of thinking, God's a creative force alongside other creative forces, and they can be positive or negative. God always is for the positive, but other forces can be positive or negative. Thank you.
So you think Hitler should get to go to the good place?
Yeah.
Or should have gotten to go to the good place?
Yeah.
And I know Donald wants to go. He's worried about it.
Yeah. Let's think about Hitler, because that's a really good question. Well, let's compare Tom Ord, me, to Adolf Hitler. I am by no means a perfect individual, but I don't think I have the negative habits for evil that Adolf Hitler had. When I die, and I continue on a subjective experience beyond bodily death, I suspect that I've got some more learning to do, some more growth, maturity, because I'm not a perfectly moral person. I'm not always responding to God's call to love moment by moment like I ought to. But I suspect Adolf Hitler's got a lot more bad habits to overcome. I suspect he's got some natural negative consequences in the afterlife as well that he's got to work through. Not because God's punishing him. I don't believe in a punishing God. But just because he's developed certain ways of being and thinking in his life that are undermining not only the well-being of others, but his own well-being. I think God never gives up on Adolf Hitler. God always forgives. Adolf Hitler might have a hard time forgiving himself and breaking some bad habits. But I think eventually even Adolf Hitler can learn to cooperate with God. I don't know that for sure, but I think love is that powerful. Wild. I'm pretty optimistic, aren't I?
Well, and then when we think of all the evil in the world, I think Hitler, you know, gets a bad rap. I mean, look at what's going on in Palestine right now.
Yeah.
With our money.
Yeah, preach it, preach it.
And we are responsible. And slavery, how was that? You know, everybody was responsible. And I just believe, like you say, that God is so loving that I think God is always out there wanting us to do better.
Yeah, I do too. You remind me of, when I was doing my doctoral work, I had as one of my professors a guy named John Cobb, who's a pretty famous process theologian. And we were in this room of about 20 students, and someone brought up the problem of evil, and of course Hitler came up. And this one student from Germany raised her hand, and she said, "Why is it every time we talk about evil, we talk about him? There's some other bad people in the world." I go, "Oh, yeah."
So this is more a question about the reality of your holding beliefs where you do.
Yeah.
So when I heard that you were teaching in Florida, that's not a place I think of as a bastion of progressivism. Right. And you know, we also live in a place that I would not consider normally to be a bastion of progressivism. So I was wondering, what's it like to believe what you believe and be loud about what you believe in the place that you're in?
Okay, I'm going to try to answer you without crying, right? First of all, let me say the place I work for in Florida, it's just an address. It's an online university, so it's not really associated with Florida. But I live in Idaho, which is even redder than Florida or South Carolina, not in terms of politics. How is it that I can have these views? Well, the truth is, in 2015, I went through a series of theology trials that ended up me losing my job as a professor of a university in the Church of Nazarene when I was an elder. Very, very painful situation. For me, my family, my colleagues, I still have trauma related to that. I went through an official trial. The trial didn't convict me as a heretic, but the president decided to get rid of me anyway, and brutal thing. Then last summer,
I was kicked out entirely from my denomination. I had been an ordained elder, a credentialed elder since 1993, but I am a queer affirming person and decided I wanted to be vocal about that. And charges were brought up against me in 2021 after a series of trials. I had an official trial last summer, and the verdict was, you're not only not going to be a minister with us, but we're taking away your entire membership. And that's painful too. So there have been some consequences for these beliefs. there's been some very good things about this as well. That's really satisfying to share these ideas and have some people find them helpful, and that's powerful. But I think it'd be fair to say I've paid a pretty high cost for these views. Yeah. But the upside is that I have a clear conscience.
Where are you now?
So now I live in Idaho.
Yeah.
And I have doctoral students around the world in open and relational theology, and they're all online. And that's my primary income as a professor working with doctoral students. And I'm writing books, obviously.
So not affiliated with the church.
Oh, denomination-wise. No, I'm not. I didn't join another denomination. I had lots of people saying, hey, come be Presbyterian or Methodist or whatever, you know? Yeah.
Did you ever get to meet students?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, good.
Tomorrow, I'm speaking at a conference in Charlotte at Park Grove Baptist Church, and about a dozen of my current former doctoral students are giving presentations on open relational theology. So, yeah.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
I just wanted to say, about life act like hopeful universalism.
Yeah.
I thought about that and Hitler and so on.
Yeah.
And I imagine that when each of us comes face to face with God, and we are face to face with God, that we cannot any longer deny who God is, and that this is, and we see ourselves in that reflection. You know what I mean?
I hope you're right. I don't know.
That changes us. It may take a while to change some of us, but that changes us.
Well, the part I like about what you're saying is that, at least when I look at my own life, the more I have affirmed and studied and embraced a view of a loving God, the more I've been changed. I mean, it doesn't happen just sort of magically, but there's something about putting your trust in a God of relentless love that inclines, I think, one, doesn't force, but inclines one to want to imitate that lover. And so given enough time, maybe that's what we're looking at.
And that's why what we just said causes me concern when you say that you're not convinced there is a God.
Yes.
You just said you put your trust in this God.
Oh.
And secondly, don't you have experiences within yourself that you recognize are not you?
I do have profound experiences from time to time, but I sometimes wonder if it's just my neurophysiology, or I had some bad pizza the night before, or, you know, I remember I went to, I remember I went on a retreat one time with a bunch of adults, and it was actually, maybe you guys have it here. You have Walk to Emmaus. Everybody heard of that? No.
Yeah.
Emmaus. Walk to Emmaus is like a 4-day retreat.
CEO, have you heard of the CEO?
Yes. Okay. And at least the one I was in, you don't know that you're going, and then all of a sudden you're doing this thing, and you're listening to speakers, you're going to bed late, you're doing these exercises, you're getting letters from people that you've influenced, your family, It's an emotional roller coaster. And then the last night, you come together after sleeping on the floor, not getting much sleep, and having these infinite, intimate conversations with strangers. You come into this church, you have a foot washing service, your family is there, and all these people are having these profound experiences. And I'm sitting there thinking, they're just sleep deprived. And they're feeling the kind of love from their family that maybe you've never felt. Now, that can be true, and God can also be acting. That's what I actually believe. But I have to admit, there's forces and factors in the world that can contribute or go against the kind of profound experiences that I and others have had. So I think still, even with those experiences, I take a risk that there really is a God. I'm not 100% certain.
Yeah.
So I serve a church in a context of many folks who struggle economically, with addiction, with mental illness, a lot of family trauma. Many of them, because of their life experience, are not college educated, if not even high school educated. So my question is, how in that context would this concept of theology connect with them? I agree, as someone was asking me, what do you think? It's great. And I said, well, you help me put a name to many of the things I've already been thinking about.
Yeah.
But I'm hesitant to completely give up the idea because it gives such hope to people that there is a God who ultimately will make everything all
right. Mm-hmm. Oh, this was the last thing for me that, yeah. I hear this a lot from especially people of color, theologians of color, liberationist theologians. Right. Look, how can I want
and
that.
And I wouldn't take that hope away from them. In fact, I love music and I love hymns, but one of my least favorite hymns in my seminary days as I was getting more educated was Victory in Jesus. Mm-hmm. I thought it was kind of hokey. Yeah. That is the favorite song.
Oh,
I mean, and I've grown to love it again because that is a song filled with hope.
Yes.
That there is victory there.
My
no matter what you're going through forever. Right now, and those folks need that.
Yes.
And I guess I would say, what do you have to offer?
I have to offer them hope, but not magic.
Yeah, earlier at the break, I asked him if he could write either a book or a chapter entitled There Are No Magic Words.
Yeah. So I think I can still offer hope to those people, but maybe not quite the way that they've been taught to think about that hope. This is a hope that involves not only them, but others, and oftentimes they're more victims than they are perpetrators of their own suffering. So they're the consequences of other people's bad choices and actions and addictions and consumerism.
And so I think what I find very helpful in all of this is the focus on love. And that's I hope to just keep the focus there too, because I think ultimately no matter what we've gone through in life, it's love that will ultimately heal us.
Yeah, yeah.
And win out. That's what you said earlier.
That's right.
Of love.
It's not just a wish and a dream. It's a real hope grounded in a God of love who never gives up.
Which I was going to ask you what you think of Rob Bell's book, Love Wins.
I generally like it, but he doesn't really give you something at the end, at least as a theologian, like I'm reading and I'm saying, okay, is the conclusion here that love wins because God always loves? Well, I'm into that. Or is the conclusion here that love wins because love will ultimately save everyone? He doesn't quite go there, but he's close.
Right.
I don't think he's quite clear there. I generally like the book, but that book actually prompted me to kind of craft my own view of this relentless love view that I've been outlining. Let me
this can't be right.
Yeah, you want a little more complexity. Let me go back though to your claim or your statement about those who are especially, let's say, impoverished, thinking about hope. I will talk to folks like that, especially those who don't have a lot of background in education and things, differently than I will like one of my colleagues in the academy.
Right.
When I'm talking to my colleagues in the academy, like one of my good friends, his name is Adam Clark, teaches at Xavier, and he's a black liberationist theologian. And we sometimes have these arguments and these discussions. And he says, well, you know, the liberation tradition is banking on a God who's going to rescue us. And you have to have omnipotence. I mean, he's not quite this strong, but he could say you have to have omnipotence to have a rescuing God. And I like to look at him and say, well, how's that working out for you? I mean, if God is omnipotent and can rescue, God is sure treating folks of your skin color pretty badly, not doing a lot of rescue. So maybe we need to have hope, but not quite that kind of hope. A hope that involves not only you, but a society that's changed. So thanks for your great comments and questions. Yeah.
I just had a comment and a question. I'm so appreciating your candor and your insights. Thank you. First, the comment is, in the past just few years, I've tended to lean on the God who told me to love my enemies. He might do the same thing in the end. And
I love it.
I like that. And so the whole idea of post-mortem salvation, as some might call it, reminds me of George MacDonald, who talks about the fire of God's love that will burn away anything that's not of love's kind.
Yes.
So I just love the relentless love chase that is out there in how you presented it. So it really resonates with me. But secondly, the question I have is in relation to omnipotence. The church fathers are all over the map about everything, but are there a few that you can point to that might challenge old ideas of sovereignty here or there?
Origen, I like it. If Christians had followed Origen rather than Augustine, we'd be a lot better off theologically. There's some things I disagree with Origen, but I generally, he's got a free will tradition. He's got a God who has always been creating, strangely enough. He's got passages. He identifies biblical passages that talk about God creating more than one heaven and earth. And he says, well, God must always be creating. So it's close to what I'm proposing. So I like Origen. You know, I'm not a scholar of church history, so I don't have lots of folks that I can point to. So I better just stop there. I'm more of a, let's create something. If I don't know it, let's think about it.
Does Idaho affect your thinking processes?
In a lot of ways, yeah. I'm an outdoors person, so I spend a lot of time in nature, and that's affects things. In fact, I'm making a movie right now on God. I'm a photographer as well, so it's God, photography, and nature. And, you know, it's a pretty independent, conservative state, so we have a lot of sort of libertarian-thinking people, you know. It's going to get done. In fact, to illustrate, I moved there from Massachusetts, and my oldest daughter, I would walk her to school, and when you came in the school door, it said on the wall, it takes a village to raise a child. And when we came to Idaho, we walked in the school door, and it said on the wall, if it's to be, it's up to me. That sums up the true philosophies of the states.